the First Name Basis podcast. This is where we chat with innovators and people in digital and talk about the times of today and talk about innovation and what's happening. With me today, I got another boy from Markham. For those of you who don't know what Markham is, it's a small town. Well, not a small town anymore. It was a small town, I guess, when we started moving there in the suburb of Toronto. And so with me, I got Nilay Patel. Nilay, welcome.
Hey.
Welcome to the First Name Basis podcast.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Brother, talk to me, man. How does a boy from Markham, what was in the water over there? I think I've had so many people who actually went to Millikan on this call, on this podcast. There was something definitely in the water over there that started inspiring and pushing out leaders.
I think so. It's a good question around how that all comes to be, but I mean, it was a great town that attracted a lot of smart families that pushed the kids hard. It was an interesting mix of backgrounds that came through at the right time. We've all ended up all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a pretty multicultural town. And, you know, growing up, it wasn't like, yeah, you may get into a fist fight and like get into all this trouble, but at the end of the day, you still got to get A's because your parents will kick your butt.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We were all immigrants. I mean, we were 98% kids of immigrant parents. And so, yeah, there's some very high expectations out there for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, the running joke, you remember, right? Got to be a doctor, got to be an accountant, or got to be, you know, an engineer. These were your options.
Yeah. I failed at all three. So,
yeah.
My parents are still disappointed. So Nilay, let's I think you got a pretty cool career path. And one thing I love talking about on this podcast is like, how did you get to where you were? There's so much insights in just with our guests sharing their stories about how they got to where they are. And I think, you know, for the young audience that's listening, or even for the executives who may feel like I'm stuck in a rut, there's so much to learn from those stories. So let's start, man. Like, let's settle and talk to me about how you got what you've done in your career.
Sure. I guess, look, I've had a very long and winding, I mean, my CV looks almost ridiculous. It's been a very long and winding road that's carried me across a few continents, and across a lot of different industries.
One of the things I want to just touch on there is the CV looking ridiculous. I think the number must be pretty high. Almost 90% of the people I think I've talked to, 9 out of 10 on this podcast, say the exact same thing. It hasn't been a straight path to where you've gotten, but there's been awesome experiences along the way to round you out for the position you're in.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, actually it's good that you called that out, right? Because it's something you joke about, saying the CV looks ridiculous, but as long as the experiences are valuable, you get to go where you want to go, right? You can tell the story you need to tell to help you take that next step. I don't think of it as anything but great. I'm very proud of sort of, you know, the weird and wacky journey I've taken.
Sure.
Starting from, you know, I did set off in a fairly straight path, which was, you know, get to engineering school. So I went to Waterloo, right? Engineering. You know, and the first moment to make an interesting life changing decision was, so this was 1999, right? .com 1.0, the world was blowing up, Silicon Valley was blowing up, and we were getting invites to go join companies in the States. And I remember distinctly going, I don't know about this internet thing. Feels like a bit of a fad. And I'm like, I'm gonna stick with. Automation and robotics, building things.
you were
like the worst decision AOL, at the time.
The AOL dial-up that you had.
No, I was like, I mean, it was already changing my life, but I just didn't have the foresight, right? Like, I'm like, you know, idiot number one. I'm like, wow, just missed out. And so I ended up, you know, robotics, automation for for Mars chocolate bar manufacturing, right? But
sure.
And then very quickly went, okay, clearly the internet's a thing. Software development wasn't going to be my path, so hardware development was. So I moved very quickly to a company called Celestica, which was the second biggest company by market cap in Canada at the time.
Yeah.
And you know, this was, we were making the first mobile phones. we were prototyping the first for Nokia, for Sony Ericsson. Obviously, yeah. This is way before iPhones, obviously. The first ATM switches. These are the backbone of the internet, right? Yeah. This is the stuff that AT&T and Verizon put around the world to give us internet. And this is the stuff we were building
back then. And for those who don't know Celestica, there's a Celestica mafia that came out of there. Like, you guys went into, like, that was
just... Oh, yeah.
That was your MBA of, like, tech working over there. The smart people that have come out of that organization.
There's a lot that I take from that experience. I stayed there 4 years, and it was, you know, what was really exciting about that space was it was filled with, and only notice this reflecting back, right, is like, it's filled with, we had 7,000 people in the building, and we were all between the ages of 22 and like 28.
And
every single person had an engineering degree. And it was, I mean, what a crazy environment. Like, you just don't find yourself in those types of environments anymore, where it's like 98% engineers and you're all in your 20s. And it was just amazing the life experiences, the learning experiences separately. But it was
my tribal skill will beg to differ. I'm the dinosaur in there with the surgery.
But I at that point, I'm like, you know, it's interesting, you know, do I just stay here? Do I just keep going, right? Do I stay, you know, do I try something radically different? And I think then I definitely had my first sort of thing I stumbled into was, you know, start just doing stuff that gets you out of your comfort zone. So I joined a bunch of, like, I started volunteering for boards. You know, basically charities. So Boys and Girls Clubs of Canada, Big Brothers and Sisters of Canada, just joined their boards. And I'm like, all right, I'm here to help. I don't know what value I can add, honestly. And they were looking for people.
And they were looking for people. And they were happy to have someone in their 20s.
I joined. That's right. So, you know, I was very impressed at the time because they were looking for people who, you know, they wanted to bring youth and diversity in and have a different perspective. You know, at that time, the boards were filled with, you know, an older generation, typically accounting, you know, or legal background. And they wanted to diversify, you know, experiences and in. And they're also looking after, these are huge, two of the biggest social charities on the continent in North America, and that look after young people, and they didn't have young people on the board. So that was an angle. There was like a service where you can just apply to boards and just see, and you can get matched. There was sort of like an analog version back then.
Sure.
And I just thought I'd have a go and just see what happens. And bizarrely, yeah, I got a call, and then I got another call. And I think you need to feel like you can do it first. But then when I sat down on the board, I definitely had imposter syndrome at that point. I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And I was definitely learning. I felt like I was learning more than I was contributing. And I'm very thankful for the organization for letting me do that. But I think that was my first window into governance. How do you run a business? How do you balance the books? You know, as an engineer, I didn't have to worry about that. We were just making money, right? And you just had no and I could see the stock price, right? These are the two things that I kept an eye on.
Even if you aren't making money, it's like, that's not my problem. I'm just doing what I got to build.
Yeah, that's not my problem. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As long as we're all getting paid, we're good, right? Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, you know, the greater responsibility all of a sudden was thrust in front of my eyes there. And I was like, wow. And I think that's when I got the itch, right? I'm like, okay, if I want to run a company or run a big division, I'm not entirely sure I can do that in very quickly if I'm going to stay on the pure, straight, narrow engineering. I can become a director of engineering in a couple of years or longer. At that time, it used to take on average. So this was like the early 2000s. The average route to director of engineering at the time was 15 years. And so, you know, I'm like, 15 years, I want to go faster than that. So that was when I'm like, all right, B school. So, you know, not an uncommon path, right? Yeah, sure. I'm sure you've had plenty of guests that have, you know, took this leap. And so that was it. I'm like, all right, I'm going out. Before I left to go do business school, I just asked, I had my sister-in-law was starting her company, a Canadian cosmetics company. Called Vasanti Cosmetics. And I'm like, hey, can I help? And I just, again, volunteered my services.
That was a big deal. I didn't know.
Yeah. That. Still going, still strong, still bigger going. Than ever.
Big
yeah.
deal. Yeah. That's a, she's like, she was ahead of her time. Like, hey, a bunch of these
way stuff, ahead of her time. Absolutely. These
brown ladies are not getting the attention or the products they deserve.
this is, I mean, just an amazing insight that the world's biggest cosmetics companies were catering to 20% of the global audience and had 80% of market share, which made no sense, right? Yeah, they were absolutely onto something. And I contributed very little, but I at the time I thought I was, and I learned a lot again. But that was when, you know, like, I'm going to go to B school. So yeah, I moved to London, England, came here, 18 years ago, I think now, did the business school thing. And again, you'll probably have had this story to some degree around, all right, look, the B school, 70 or 65% of the graduates typically end up in consulting or an investment bank.
Yep.
And I made a promise to myself that wasn't going to happen. I wasn't going to touch investment banking and I wasn't going to touch consulting. I was going to go look for that fundamental career shift. That's something I love and blah, blah, blah. Got all enamored with the big dream and really struggled for my first internship, for the internship that you do midway between the first and second year, to get that big, crazy, beautiful job that wasn't in banking. So I ended up doing a banking job because it was actually easier to get that. Get a job that paid, you know, crazy money. And so I did M&A at CIBC World Markets here in the UK in London, and, you know, lived that nightmare of a crazy job. Learned a lot, said I've done
you're,
it.
But I'm, you know, like, what it taught you, work ethic, if anything, because you're just grinding all the time over there. Just
grounded out, and I learned a ton and closed a huge transaction, which was exciting. Learned about the gaming industry, the casino industry in Europe. And, you know, I learned a ton, but knew I was never going to do that. And then sadly, the exact same thing happened when it was time to graduate. I know, I'm like, all right, well, this time I'm definitely not going, and I'm going to definitely do something that's extraordinary and different and blah, blah, blah. Went through the whole process, but you got to have nerves because all those jobs, you got to hold out and you got to wait and you got to network.
And there's significant offers. You're like, am I going to have, like, is there a next offer? Like,
exactly.
Like, that's a hard.
And you're playing games. All your friends in school at B school are all locking up their jobs, getting their bonuses, getting their signing bonuses. And you're like, so I came up to the end of towards the end of the school year. And I was among the last 20% that was still holding out, that I hadn't signed anything.
And living in an expensive city, that's London.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, like the money, the power, the fame, like it's
easy. I had taken a huge loan to pay for this. I'm like, this is, and I basically lost my nerve. I lost my nerve. And I'm like, all right, took an interview with a consulting firm, got the offer, took the signing bonus. I'm like, this is, I feel better now.
Yeah.
And sold out, totally sold out. But interestingly enough, while in the time that, you know, before I started, because I don't start for a couple of months, I got approached to by a Middle Eastern company called Algonim Industries. Okay. And they're like, look, this young man has been gifted the largest privately owned conglomerate in the Middle East, and he's looking to westernize his business, and he wants to hire some deputies. And do you want to go meet with him? And I'm like, absolutely. And I won't go through the nuances.
Look how far you are from Markham at that point.
and it was a whirlwind of madness and before I knew it, I was in Kuwait, you know, working on a portfolio of this guy's companies, and it was extraordinary. Did that for a little while, and then ultimately moved back to London mainly for personal reasons. Like, I'm not going to be shy. I was single. It just wasn't the right place to meet my person out in the Middle East, for me at least. So came back to London, and then had to take up that consulting firm back on their offer and go, hey, you hired me once, will you hire me again? And like, absolutely. I mean, that was part of their model. They brought me back in, did that for a year. And it was exactly like what happened with investment banking, right? I was like, this, not for me. I just not
able to
do this. And I learned so much, right? And so this is one of those things. Every time you feel like you've taken a bad turn, it's like two things come out of it. One, you earned a stripe. I earned a stripe. I did that. I've done management consulting. I lived the life of grinding it out 4 days a week in some other country, working in my case, it was big pharma, was my sector, creating drugs, creating drug markets. I mean, it was stuff I'm not entirely proud of at one level, but it was, I learned so much.
Sure.
And then, just went, all right, it's time. I think I've got my feet under my ground. Let's start following some dreams here. Let's start looking for stuff where I'm going to have a different type of impact. And, circled back, ended up in the digital space, AOL. Ended up at AOL Europe. And You know, this is one of those. Yeah. And, you know, it was at that time they had, you know, they owned Time Warner.
Sure.
Right. It was the beast. It was the biggest ISP in Europe across all the European, continents. You know, just I can't even remember the metrics that it ran, but it was just monstrous. So anyways, I ended up as the European commercial director for AOL. Right. And I wasn't a digital expert, not digital content expert, but, you know, I learned business development, corporate development. I learned about content acquisition. I just learned and learned. And I'll tell you an interesting story. So this is fairly well known now, but basically here's one of those twists of fate, Chico, that can fundamentally change your, you know, direction of travel. So AOL, Time Warner was looking to spin AOL out.
Yeah.
As a separate company, after all these, you know, AOL bought Time Warner, and then it flipped ultimately. Yeah. There's 99% value destruction over 10 years.
Business models completely changing. I mean, there's epic case studies on, you know, exactly. Steve Chase's vision and what happened afterwards, right?
And I was living it firsthand. Tim Armstrong had joined, taken over as CEO, and his job was, you know, spin AOL out at the highest share price possible. Mm-hmm. And he flies over to London, meets with me and the rest of the senior team. And he's like, hey, how much is it going to cost to make AOL Europe, at that time operating in, I think, 11 territories, to make it profitable? Because basically we were marginally unprofitable, marginally.
Gotcha.
And he's like, have a think. And he's like, work it out. And did the math, brought it back. And I came back and I remember I was on a board. I dialed into a board call. I'm on a BlackBerry. And I'm like talking into the BlackBerry. We're all out and
it was blue back then. It was a blueberry.
Blueberry. Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, look, it's going to cost roughly $500 million. And in 5 years, we'll turn the ship around. And I've never heard so many expletives thrown at me in such a formal setting. It was extraordinary. And basically, he's like, try again, dude. There's no way we're giving you $500 million to like make Europe profitable. Wow. And I went home, you know, tail between my legs. And I was talking to my flatmate.
That's a huge ask. If you go back into like that time, like $500 million, like that's a huge nut. I mean, now we talk trillions and all this stuff, but like $500 million is a huge number.
Yeah. It does feel big back then, but AOL, I think people forget just that company was kicking out $10 billion in free cash flow. Like it was nothing. And I remember my flatmate at the time, he's like, Neil, what, I told him what happened. And he's like, well, what would you do? Like, seriously, what's a better option? I go, seriously, I think the best thing to do is freaking shut down all these countries we're not profitable in. Keep London, keep UK, because AOL is America online. And it is terrible at localizing in Italy and France and Germany. And,
for sure.
You know, and he's like, well, then why don't you just do that? Pitch that. And I'm like, that's crazy. No one's going to want to hear shut down countries.
They won't make it profitable. And, what you're thinking they want to hear, like turn that country around, not shut that country down.
And that was it. He talked to me and he goes, what do you got to lose? And it was true. And I went and I had a conversation off the record with a company that is corporate turnarounds. And I said, here's my problem. And they said, here's how you approach it. And I slipped a memo into one of the execs' briefcases effectively, said, here's my pitch. And no joke. I think it was under 2 weeks. It was approved. The plan was approved. Oof. And it was a $200 million investment to shut down effectively to exit. Yeah. And it will be profitable in 6 months because we'll exit and we'll keep the one profitable territory, which was the UK. And, and it was done.
Your ROI model worked a lot better.
And it was great. And I got to spearhead the exit and I got to be put on a very senior team, way above my pay grade, got to be part of that team, you know, rode on the coattails of some amazingly smart people and got to ride that out. And then that was it. I got to like pick my job after that almost. Right. It was amazing. So the connections I made got me the economist job and I got to go, that was it. That was my first big aha moment, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of our general counsel in Europe was the former general counsel at The Economist, right? Global brand.
Gotcha.
And he's like, he called them up and went, guys, you're doing this thing called the digital transformation. This is when that phrase was literally just being coined, right? Yeah. And Steve Jobs had held up the iPad and The Economist is sitting there going, I think that's going to change things. And they're like, we need a person to come in and tackle this problem. And it was because I knew somebody. It was purely a relationship. It was serendipity. It was the right place, the right time. And but they took a chance.
That's not really serendipity, because you worked your ass off to get to that moment, to be in the position to have that meeting, and that person know you also. Like a lot of people think, hey, you know, it's luck. You just ended up knowing that. I was like, it took me 38 years to actually meet that person. If you really think about it, my entire life, I grinded to meet that person. And now 2 years later, I'm working with that person at my age of 40. Like, this is struggle that I hate to put myself in. And so I don't want you to downplay it, because I think, like, working with the younger generation too much, like a lot, they think luck is just happens. And sure, there's an essence of being lucky, but your hard work and what the decisions you make are what put yourself in that lucky situation.
Yeah. Look, you're right. I think the one of the things that I think I can speak to that very point was that probably allowed this one individual to vouch for me and make that, you know, he turned around and just pitched me without me even knowing back to The Economist. And I remember hearing on the other side when I got hired, they're like, you know, one of the things he said was, this guy joined, he was with us for 4 years, and he basically ran one of the biggest deals this, you know, the European business ever did. He never once asked for more money to do his job. Like I took zero pay raises in 4 years, and I was getting paid, I was getting paid like 60 grand to do, I was the European commercial director of AOL Europe. I was on 60K, right? And, you know, and it was like, just keep adding value. So like, if there's any advice at this point in my career, I was like, just keep adding value. Just keep putting your hand up to do stuff, keep pitching ideas, and eventually it works out. And that's what happened. You get The Economist gig, the gig, and I got right-sized. My salary got reset. My responsibility got reset. Everything got formalized. And then I got to another stage of my career. But I'm not entirely sure I would have.
It's almost like they paid you 60 grand a year to go to their school.
I got another schooling. I got way better schooling in that 4 years than I did in the 2 years of B school by a country margin.
And you paid for B school. At least you got 60 grand from this one.
And I'm still paying for my B school, I think. I mean, after that, it was, you know, global brand. You get a tailwind of like, everything's easy, I think, when you've got a brand that's as trusted and as known and understood, you know. And I had a product. I created a product that was being used by Obama in the White House. You know, Bill Gates wrote to us to say how much he loves you. But, you know, we're operating on a whole nother level.
Sure.
You know, when you have, you know, and it was an extraordinary experience. Steve Jobs wrote to me saying, "Where's the Economist app on the iPhone?" Because, you know, it was starting. That was like the beginning of. I was like, "Wow, he wrote," and I got to write him back, and I'm like, I'm not sure I've got the resources to do this right now. I'm thinking this through. And he flew 10 people over from Cupertino to London.
Here you go. Let me help you out.
And I'm like, it was my mind was like exploding, right? It was again, right place, right time in the time. I mean, I'm saying this more in the arc of the disruption that the iPhone and the iOS world had on the world. I happened to be in a print media business that was making that transition. And that was a rocket ship, right? We just went for it. Yeah. And, you know, that brought the advent of, well, not the advent, but the push into video and then the push into audio from a journalistic perspective. Mm-hmm. And then that took me then to my next journey, which was the BBC. You know, I thought I wasn't quite playing British enough. It was time to go one level. At this time, I'm married and to a Brit, and I'm like, I don't think I'm quite there until I do the BBC. So
beggars and mash is not necessarily like enough right now.
So that's when the next big and we talk about mafias, right? So AOL mafia, you know, roles all over the world as we know. And the chief digital officer of the BBC at the time was an ex-AOL exec, Ralph Rivera, who came and found me at The Economist and said, come take over television, come take over radio from a digital perspective and start blowing this stuff up. And, you know, that's when the playing space just got so big, right? Because that's when I went from having, you know, 6 million monthly users to 10 million daily users, you know, and then just up from there, and right? So the landscape just got big and then just up. So, yeah, had an extraordinary ride working with some of the smartest, you know, one of the fascinating things that people won't appreciate outside of the UK is the BBC as an institution, that it's like, it's a place where I have never been surrounded by the more smart people in the world. So, you know, it's almost like you, people go there again to get schooled and deliver public service. And it's like a civic duty that people, you know, they could be making $500,000 somewhere else, but like, no, I do this because of, you know, my duty to country and public service, because I was brought up on the BBC and it did so much for me. And it was just a beautiful, and still is a beautiful organization.
Very, very trusted brand. I mean, if you take a look at even the, if we talk about the Times of today, you take a look at the political polarization of media right now.
And oh yeah.
The cesspool it has become, where you got to fact check every reporter and what they're saying. I mean, when you got a president, you got to fact check every single time now also. But like, the BBC is still like one of the places that if I'm reading, I'm like, it's trusted. I trust what they're saying.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, it never felt like
BS out of
it. It never felt like that one on the inside. Yeah, but that's the currency, right? That's the currency in journalism, and that we had to play with, and that, you know, that was it. That was the MO. But like, it wasn't until I was in there that I'm like, oh my god, we're 4 times bigger than Twitter. Like, we're this is huge, right? BBC News is just ginormous, and the global influence was remarkable. And so yeah, I got to learn a lot about obviously the world of television. The craft of storytelling, the craft of, you know, the whole world of TV production, rights, windows, you know, digital distribution.
That's so tough, right? You got over BBC there. You got BBC for the UK, you got BBC International, you got BBC, like, you got 20 different strategies all going at the same time.
Yeah.
And then just content distribution, digital rights, everything that comes with media, it becomes a big spider web so fast, and I don't think people appreciate enough. I'm a media guy also, so I get it. But I don't think our listeners understand the amount of things you can and can't do. It's just not as easy as pushing any video out to anyone.
No, it's a truly fascinating space. Like, I think I started, my curve was like, oh my god, this is horrifying when I was learning about it, too. This is just bewildering and exciting at the same time. And how do we navigate? How do we help the creative industry move into a world where they can put their shows up on Netflix or on iPlayer and the BBC in the UK? You know, and then you know, the same extended into audio and radio.
You still got connections there. And for when Pete Tong and his Essential Mix comes back, like, can't iPlayer just allow everybody outside of the UK to listen to it? Like, do I actually have to illegally download every Essential Mix? Because you know I'm doing it, but you're not giving me access.
I know. So BBC Sounds, you can get the audio only. Video rights international, almost impossible. Audio, sure. BBC Sounds is gearing up for an international. So that's the audio. That's the audio equivalent.
Yeah.
Good got, question. And always,
I've got thousands of viruses trying to download this thing.
you're like, I get a weekly report of all the VPN hitters on our service globally, and I knew Shita was one of them. Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. But yeah, it was an amazing process. And I think the last big thing there was sort of that whole, and ironically, what we're doing right now, right? The world of podcasting, right? Was, sure. So this was what, 6 years ago, I was like, this is it, right? We've got to, the BBC was already Europe's largest source of podcasts and probably the world's probably number 4 at the time, but still wasn't leaning in. It was just doing it just for fun. And it was already big. So like, my whole mission at the end was like, how do we lean in and make BBC the center, global center of podcasting? And so it was great. I got to, you know, really push that agenda. And you know, obviously BBC's taken off from that perspective, from a podcasting perspective. And then I felt sort of my, you know, and helped the BBC transition into music as well. And just sort of in a world where with its TV, it had a good 4-year head start on Netflix when it came to streaming. Sure. It was an audio. It was a good 4 years behind Spotify, right? So it had a problem it had to solve there, which was very different. So got to get very involved in that, which is really exciting. Awesome. And then now I'm where I'm at now, which is
a couple, again, like, this is not a straight road. When you tell me, like, you got this amazing position at the BBC, you and I are chatting and you're doing these awesome initiatives over there and you're solving complex problems. And then I end up talking to you and you're like, yeah, I'm going to the education space. And I'm like, what the F are you doing? But talk to me, what happens there?
Yeah. Well, I think, well, first, let's just backtrack. So I think it's really important for everyone to appreciate, if anyone's listening, right? Like, when I joined The Economist, I knew nothing about the world of publishing.
Sure.
And it didn't matter, right? The objective view is very valued. And so I just want everyone to appreciate that you don't need to have deep, deep domain knowledge in the entirety of your business, right? What they valued were other things, right? Mm-hmm. You know, commerciality, you know, et cetera, right? Digital distribution or whatever. I knew nothing about television when I got to BBC. I knew nothing about radio, and play that to a strength. An objective outsider's view of something can really be powerful, can actually make all the difference. So fast forward to now, which was education. So I didn't really pay that close attention to the world, the evolving world of education and education technology. I'm chief executive of a company called Digital Theater. Digital Theater is an online learning platform focused entirely on the performing arts, which, now, if there's something I really know nothing about, this is it. Right. I mean, I was a music nut through and through. I loved TV. You know, you still love these things, right? And I love to read, but I mean, I stayed so far clear of the world of performing arts in terms of, you know, I hated Shakespeare as a kid. You know, we talked about this last week. I just hated all this stuff, right? And it was just a foreign language, right?
For our listeners, we had a good chat about Shakespeare because I kind of enjoyed it. I was enjoying it.
Yeah, turns out Sheetal's a thespian. And I was like, it was truly a foreign language. And it was when this company was presented to me as going, well, this is for you. This was for you 30 years ago. You know, you're the kid. You're the 80% in the room who it's mandatory time to start learning Twelfth Night or Romeo and Juliet, whatever it is.
Sure.
And the teacher goes, all right, here's a book. Here's the play. Go home and read it. And you're like, oh my God, you go home and you're like, I don't understand any of this stuff.
What the heck?
This makes no sense.
Yeah.
Then you come back to school the next day. The teacher's, all right, let's discuss this. You're like, discuss what? I don't know what we're talking
gibberish,
about.
Right? Gibberish.
And you're on your back foot, right? And then, you know, put that in a different context, right? Put that in the context of you're either the son of an immigrant family who don't take this stuff very seriously, or you're unlike me, where we were fairly, you know, we were affluent enough. We could have gone to the theater if we wanted to.
Sure.
You know, we had the money to do so, but most of the world don't. They either don't have the money or they're nowhere near a quality theater, right?
Yep.
And the idea, you can't, you know, there's a wealthy, so, you know, a socioeconomic sort of group that get to go to the theater and are privileged to go. And you, if you're not in that space, you're on your back foot again, right? Mm-hmm. And you just don't get exposure. You don't get access to this incredible world. So anyways, that's what this business was set out to try to help solve for teachers, for students, create a level playing field. If you're going to study Twelfth Night, watch a movie or a capture of a live production that's got someone you recognize, make it real for you, and then supplement it with all the learning require all the learning materials you need to help ace your tests. Whether you're in high school, middle school, university, college, doesn't matter. We've got it for everybody.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're a teacher, then unlock value for teachers. Save them time, right? Teach them how to teach it. You know, we hit it from every angle. So mm-hmm. That's what we do. I still don't claim to know anything about theater, but I'm on a long curve here. Yeah,
for sure. Well, look, the pandemic hits and now all of a sudden everything needs to be online. Your job and your experience of everything you've done, especially with video production and pushing content out to users in masses, becomes really relevant. And so how has it been for your organization? Like, I'm guessing it's this hockey stick metric that you got to go, that all of a sudden this user demand gets generated, but shit breaks.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, what are some of the challenges that you've been going through and have you been overcoming them?
Sure. So I think there's probably two strands here that happen at the same time. One, there's just the general, and you can clearly relate to this, the world of startups, right? Mm-hmm. Independent of a global pandemic, it's a ride, right? And you get the ups, you get dramatic ups and you get dramatic downs, whether it's staying, you know, staying on, keeping the growth or having enough money in the bank and attracting the right talent, all of those facets, right? So
and it's challenging, right? Like no matter when you're on a leadership team of a startup, it's like, I got a job to do to actually build this thing. But at the same time, we're running out of money and I got to figure out how to raise as well. And at the same time, I'm having other fires that I got to put out and the market's like, it's just...
So there's, yeah, there was all of that, which is just normal and for this environment and par for the course. And then there was the COVID, effect. So to kind of summarize the interesting journey we went on was, fundraising, critical funding round fell through because it was being done and concluded literally while the markets were closing. The schools were closing and the markets were dropping 20%. And all of our investors just said, we're going to back out for now. We'll come back later and we'll want a discount. You know, you have to live, you know, you have to deal with that. And I was one of many, many institutions dealing with that same challenge. We make our business by calling schools up and letting them know about our product. Right. And overnight, every school in the world, we operate in 95 countries, every school in the world shut down. And overnight, we didn't have a single person to call. There's no, because they're not at school. And it's like, I can call them at home. I don't have their home number.
You don't have a home number. I mean, you're going to send an email. They may not even be checking like their home. There's no school.
So, you know, absolute double nightmare situation. Now, luckily, we happen to be, again, you know, timing's everything, as we all know. So we're an online learning platform. And whilst we originally, you know, the company's been designed, the proposition has been designed on the principle of a flipped classroom, i.e., you know, it's a hybrid model, right? You never throw away, you know, the extreme value of teaching in person in that high touch environment. But when it went completely online, the world went completely online from the school's perspective. We were beautifully placed to serve a need, and it showed. So overnight, schools went away, but then the next week, 6,000 institutions called us, and our world just went from bleak to blistering sun of oh my God, this is amazing. But then you got operational problems, right?
Yeah, but the biz dev guy in me asked, how do they know to call you? Like, what did you guys already do a bunch of pre-work and reaching out and you planted those seeds before? Like, how did they even find you?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Yeah. Good question. So yeah, obviously it wasn't just they found us. So we are at the very early stage in terms of market penetration. So awareness of our business is still very low. The marketing team went to work, put together an email campaign, because it's the only medium we can play with and on social. And we talked about our core strengths, you know, the flip class, the virtual classroom, as opposed to the flip classroom. And our content team went to work very quickly to create teaching guides on how to teach in an entirely virtual environment. And we gave it away for free. And we said, here's how you do it. If you want to learn more, call us. And they called. That was it. And we got inundated because it's one thing to have access to a platform. It's another to even know what to do with it.
If for all of our listeners, it is so much easier to sell with thought leadership and not look for anything in return. Like, here, I'm going to give you my thought.
Just have it.
Take it. If you like what I'm saying and you believe in what I'm doing, then let's work together. You don't have to commoditize every single part of your business. Actually, if you play the longer game, especially with thought leadership and helping someone before you get to a monetary relationship, that relationship's valued a ton more. I mean, that's something I preach to our team all the time.
Now, it's a really important point. And I'm not going to pretend like I ever get these things right the first time. Like we struggled internally, right? The team, the marketing team rocked up, went nearly. We the content teams put together this amazing stuff. We want to give it away. And I'm like, no chance, right? I'm like, this is valuable stuff. No one else is doing this. You don't put our price point to zero, right? And we argued and, you know, we found a compromise, right? And we go put out a certain, let's see how it works, right? So, you know, the most important aspect was test and learn. So as long as you've got that, then it allows your eyes to be opened up if they need to be opened up, which is exactly what happened, right?
And at the same time, I mean, what do you got to lose? Like, you have nothing to lose.
That was clearly the right logic.
Right.
But one can be clouded with fear,
of course.
Which, you know, as you know, with what's going on, cash, versus giving it away.
Yeah, and thinking, hey, what are investors going to approve of this? They may not like this. I mean, there's a million.
Yeah. Or there's so many things that go through your mind, right? Yeah, but the right answer, it turned out, was luckily the one we made in the end, but it was not necessarily the first thing that came to mind. It was a learning experience in a good way, and it blew up. We've taken off since. We've grown 100%, over 100% since the pandemic, and we closed our funding round. We're fully funded, all sunshine and rainbows from one perspective.
Awesome.
However, we're moving into a really uncertain environment, right? So, just because we're doing great now, it's still, there's a lot, there's a whole rethinking.
You just got past like the first three hurdles of what.
That was it.
And you don't know how many more hurdles there are.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's so many unknowns to come our way. But at the same time,
what's parallel. Happening? I'll share something with you actually
before you go on.
This is very parallel to us. I mean, we saw our business just get halted 85 to 90% overnight. And I'm looking around going, I got amazing people here. And now what do I do? And so you should never give away anything for free. But I was like, F this. Let's go do meaningful work and let's ride this out as a tribe together. So let's go invest back in our customers. So I started doing discovery workshops for free. I was like, hey, this stuff that I would charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for, I'm like, you know what? No partner's going to stand up for you right now like I am. I am going to take my resources, my time, my effort, my money, and invest it back in you. And yeah, I went and did
the
that.
Right thing to do. Yeah.
Did that right for our customers. It was a tough summer. And, everybody's looking around at each other like, this awesome work we're doing, we don't know if it's going to get greenlit. And here we are now at the end of November, and we're hiring like crazy because so many of those projects became reality. And we are the trusted partners for those customers now. They're like,
they're going to remember that, right? You're there for them, you need your customers to be healthy and thriving.
Yeah.
In their time of need, if you are able to lend a hand, then that pays back dividends in the long term, right?
Absolutely. The long game made so much more sense to just do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We to that point, which is quite an issue, we got caught in a really interesting conundrum around, you get schools basically saying, we're getting our budget slashed, the whole thing's we're basically in tatters over here operationally, before it settled down a little bit, they were just, and they're like, you owe us. And there's this notion of like, you owe us almost. And the industry coming to organizations like ours, just saying, and the government even saying, if you can do it, you owe them. And I remember finding that a really challenging,
I'm a private enterprise. I owe someone.
I both agreed and disagreed, to different aspects of that argument. And the key
just so I understand the argument, the owe us is like, you guys have something that the people really need. And because of the pandemic, you owe them to do this.
Yeah, because my customers are not private enterprises for the most part. Right. Like, so private school is one thing, but let's talk about state-funded, majority of the public school. Right. They're like, hey, you run a company that is here for the greater and good. And right now your country needs you, or our country or America needs you, or the New York State School Board needs you. Sure. And the kids need you. The parents need you. This is not my client's not like, I say, a private enterprise going, I could really use the free stuff because I can turn a profit. This is, we just need stuff. And that's real. And so it was a really interesting kind of balancing act where it was true. And I believed in what they're asking. And I just had to make sure I gave as much as I could without putting the company in jeopardy and playing the long game as well. And going, look, I'm not asking for any favors. If I'm going to do this, I'm doing this because I think it's the right thing to do. And we did what we could in the right ways. And we in turn, it was a really good exercise because what we ended up doing was in turn, flipping to this is the far smarter people that work in the organization and had the right connections, turned to the theater industry and said, hey, you A-list stars, guys that are that are stars of the screen and the theater at the stage, can you help contribute to digital theater and in turn help the schools and educators? And we did a couple of really good projects. So one, we had you know, a couple of great actors really came through and just put together these amazing workshops for students and teachers. And we just gave that away for free. Like, this is all yours. Go
free masterclass. There you go.
Yeah. Free masterclasses. And it was great. It was, you know, it wasn't, we put in a little bit of investment, mm-hmm. and the investment time on theater on the actors was their time. There's no opportunity cost for them. Mm-hmm. And we were able to pass it all through, and everyone's contributing, which I really believed in. I thought was great.
See, your charity board experience.
It really paid off.
Experience came in handy. We all went
full circle. But I'm not going to lie, though. My capitalistic mind all of a sudden was like, I'm stuck. What do I do? I want help. But at the same time, it was a fascinating process to have to go through. But look, I think one of the wonderful things that have come out of one of the most horrible situations of COVID is that the education industry, there's been a forcing function to really take a hard look at how best to be more efficient from a teaching perspective, how to adopt technologies. Now they were forced into this, but now they're like, hey, this is great, right? We're like, yeah, we've been trying to tell you. And there's, forget us, there's just the whole world. There's so much out there that needs to be reflected upon in terms. Yeah.
I think education is such an awesome space where, you know, if there was a math teacher who's the best math teacher in the world, and like every student who goes to that math teacher just crushes it, how can we leverage technology now to like leverage that person, how they're doing it so effectively for everyone? And like these insightful moments that you can now have. And I see my nieces and nephews when they get in front of a screen, as much as we want to turn off their screen time, how engaged they are. How engaged people can be online. Nothing will replace one-on-one and has a time and place for it. But, you know, if there is an engagement level that is through the roof when people are online, then how could we tap into them to make it for the greater good, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, look, I think what you're tapping into something I refer to as sort of accessibility, which is you have the star teacher example. It's just one of many examples, right? And it could be either the star teacher who not everyone in your district or your province or your school board gets access to, right? There's, sure. and not all students get to have that star teacher as their teacher. That's an accessibility challenge that's inherent in the system. There's the textbook. You can make it analog, right? There's the textbook. So not every school gets access to those school books or those textbooks, right? There's accessibility issues all the way through. And I think one of many things that technology can offer is more of a level playing field from that perspective. Sure. You still run into an issue that not every kid's got access to blazing internet or the right screen or device, but that is a problem that's being inherently solved at very rapid cycles right now. And it's you know, the gaming industry is pushing that for us almost, right? Yeah. It will take care of that, right?
Well, also,
there's so much there.
Being a product of your environment and not having access, as you said, like whether it be high speed internet or whatever, but like what you are able to do now is actually be able to have this notion of having being able to consume content. And, you know, I'm an investor in the Knowledge Society, shout out to them and TKS and like the amazing work they do with kids, because they're like, hey, education is just, there's got to be a better way. And when I talk to the kids, one of the first things they say to me is still the network effect of being able to be humans and be people who actually interact with one another. And they're like, I thought I was the weirdo in the class because quantum physics was super interesting to me and I'm 13 years old, mm-hmm. and everybody else around me doesn't give it, doesn't care at all.
Yeah.
Now I found others who are interested in the human genome or artificial intelligence. And we're all supporting each other in this community effect of actually showing people who may not have the right environments to be able to thrive. You can now start to replicate online. And that is something I think that is hopefully for the next generations, as you and I get older and start to retire, we're going to be left in really good hands.
I've no doubt. I mean, you're speaking to something you and I grew up on, the benefit, which is that when the network effect kicks off, mm-hmm. you know, whether for us, it was chat rooms. Right. Yeah. All of a sudden, you know, you found your people, whatever it was, right?
Finding them, you're typing ASL, you know, and, another 2 seconds, and like nobody. Yeah. It was a cesspool, dude. There was nothing good in those chat rooms.
You okay, think there was a dark side. I'm not gonna lie. No, there's definitely a dark side, without a doubt. There was definitely a dark side. But that sense of community and the power of networks to bring people together with from a common purpose, right? There's that applies, you know. I mean, that's ultimately Facebook, right? Today, right? That is sure. Versions of Twitter. That is all the social networking tools, all trade on that premise.
Absolutely.
And for good and for bad. And you know, there's a for good version that almost to your TK thing, connecting people of the similar mind and heart together. And you can do that in education, you can do that with teachers, you can do that in, you know, with students, you can do that from so many perspectives. Sure. Real powerful tool.
Look, I know we're running out of time, but Nilay, I wanted to ask you, how do you feel this pandemic's gonna play out now? Like we're taping this at the end of November. There's huge promise for vaccines. How do you see the next year coming out? You were going to go play some bets or play some breadcrumbs in front of you. What do you see happening?
Yeah. So look, I've got probably the same information that most people have. You know, we're going to have a few vaccines, and more to come with various levels of efficacy. I suspect by, late spring, early summer, we're going to see at least the 5 to 10 biggest economies in the world have access to the vaccines writ large across their communities. We'll start to see probably by summer the slow bit returning to a new, slightly different normal. Some industries are going to have really prevailing, long-standing impacts where they're going to take a long time to get back into the swing of things. I'm of the personal view that I think the vaccine came within a time frame that allows humans who have a very short sort of attention, you know, memory, very short memory, will crave social interaction to such a degree, we are going to force ourselves to forget the dark 2020 that we lived through and are going to push through and try to resume a new normal. Obviously, it won't get back to the full new normal, but we're going to get very close, I think. I think it just came in the nick of time where the scar tissue will be limited.
Yeah. You know, just on that, like when you said crave attention, I was having a conversation yesterday about, we were talking about CES and we're like, oh yeah, it's all online this year, CES. And sure, it's a great boondoggle. I mean, CES was great that, sure, you learned some stuff during the day, but it was all about the social interaction. Everybody was there in one city in Vegas and you got to meet people you work with and do meetings with from all over the world. And they were like, do you think it'll ever come back in the same way? And I was like, I think the next time it's in person, it's going to be bigger than ever. Because we as humans are like, oh, you damn right I'm going. I can't wait to be with and everyone else I hang out in one room around the chandelier bar at the Cosmo. You know, like we are rushing to go to these events.
I've told my wife already, South by Southwest 2022, sign me. I'm plugging it in now. I'm going to be there for the whole time. Like I'm not leaving.
Dude, I'm doing it with you. We'll get an Airbnb together.
Let's do it.
We got to do some workouts though, man. I mean, I gain like 5 pounds I get a pound every day I'm there.
We can do that. That can be arranged.
Awesome. Nilay, thank you so much for coming on, man. I could chat with you for hours. And I'm sure our listeners are really appreciate you coming on here. You dropped a ton of knowledge on us, a ton of insight on us, the good, the bad, the ugly. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming, brother.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care, man.